Blog Talk Radio.
Hey, what's good, everybody? This is John Boy, a.k.a. Mr. Virginia, and I want to invite all of our music lovers to join my addiction and get hooked on books. Please visit www.hiphopandbooks.com and see how we can work together to get others to fall in love with reading again. To find out more about me, visit www.myspace.com/JohnBoyCEO.
Thank you for that, John Boy, and for all of our listeners, thank you for joining us for another edition of Conversations Live, where we connect you live with the artists and authors you love who bring you the music and books you can't get enough of. I'm your host, Cyrus Webb, and before we begin, let me first welcome our listeners in Arkansas, Louisiana, Alabama, Tennessee, Mississippi, Texas, and also California. Hello, too, to all of you who are listening to us live online, as well as by podcast, and thank you for joining us for the show. We have a terrific hour for you today. It's definitely one of my favorite authors will be joining us. He's the author of over 30 novels that have been in print, many of them New York Times bestsellers, and he's now celebrating the success of his newest release that just came out last week, Faces of Fear. Our guest for today will be none other than Mr. John Saul. He'll be joining us for the hour. Before we get into that, we definitely want to pay tribute to our sponsors for this show. One of them is the Patrick Smith Band out of Mississippi. This is their song, Every Now and Then. When we come back from the Patrick Smith Band, we'll be joined live with John Saul. Enjoy. We'll be right back. There you have it, my friends, the Patrick Smith Band and their song, which is definitely one of my favorites, Every Now and Then. For those that are just joining us, welcome to Conversations Live, where we connect you with the artists and authors you love who bring you the music and books you can't get enough of. And today we definitely have a show that you will want to go back and listen to time and again. As I mentioned earlier, he's one of my favorite authors, has been thrilling and scaring readers for years. He's now celebrating his newest release, Faces of Fear. We'll talk about that and his amazing career in just a moment, but please help me welcome best-selling author John Saul. How are you, John?
I'm great. How are you?
Look, I'm doing great, and welcome back to Conversations.
Thank you.
We have a lot we want to try to cover, John. You have had such an amazing career that, you know, I definitely want to get into that. But as I mentioned in my introduction, you have had over 30 novels that have been out. Many of them have been national bestsellers. I'm just wondering, is there ever a time that you still pinch yourself and say that, you know, is this really my life?
Oh, practically every day. It's very strange. I still every now and then go out, look in the rack, see my books up there, and think, what are my books up there on the racks with the real writers doing? But we all seem to feel that way. So I think we all pinch ourselves all the time.
You know, one of the things that I remember from our first interview that we did last year, John, when you were actually celebrating the release of The Devil's Labyrinth then, you said that your career as a writer was something that had to happen because you couldn't really do anything else. I find that hard to believe, but tell our listeners what you mean by that.
Well, I was sort of the kid who never quite met his potential in school. I did fine up until college when I wound up going to, I think, 4 colleges for 5 degrees with no degree. And needless to say, my family was not thrilled with that. My mother took to referring to it as John's 5-year paid vacation. And, of course, I came out of it with nothing to show except a whole lot of life experience, which turns out to be the best experience for a writer anyway. But had I actually graduated, I suspect that I would have gotten myself a good, honest job somewhere doing something useful. As it was, having no degree, no credential, and no completed skills, all I was left with was what I really wanted to do anyway, which was write. And fortunately, it turned out I was a pretty good natural writer because, of course, never going at anything the easy way, it never occurred to me to take a course in writing to find out if I was doing it right. I just sort of winged it, and it turned out I'm pretty good at winging it sometimes.
Well, you know, with your career, though, I'm curious with your career as a writer.
Mm-hmm.
You said that you were good at it, but when did all of that start? Have you always been a person that enjoyed the power of words, or when did that love develop for you?
Well, when I think back on it, I remember I always loved vocabulary when I was in grade school. Spelling was not always my strongest suit, but it was rare that they could come up with a word that I didn't know the meaning of, or if I didn't, I would figure it out or look it up immediately. When I was in 7th grade, the English teacher laid out an assignment very early on, the first week, and said, okay, I'm going to be giving you all a list of 20 spelling and vocabulary words each week, and on Friday you'll be tested on the spelling, and you will also turn in a piece of paper in which you've used each of the words in the sentence. So I went home, and I thought, maybe what if I use all of the words in a sentence? So I went through the 20 words, and I constructed a long run-on sentence, turned it in, and was immediately told to stay after school, at which point the teacher told me that I had obviously known what the true assignment was and willfully not bothered to play by the rules. But then he said, but now you have me interested, so I'll tell you what. You keep on doing what you've been doing, and I'll see if I can come up with a list of 20 words at some point this year that you can't cram into one sentence. And at the end of the year, I had won. And he said, it never occurred to me that I would ever tell a 7th grader to consider a career as a writer, but I'm telling you, I think you should. So that put the bug in my head, and it sort of never left. It was always just sort of buzzing around back there. And so I was always toying with the idea, and eventually when it became clear that if I was ever going to have any kind of reasonable life, I was going to have to earn my living writing, I got more serious about it and went to work.
Well, you know, I first discovered you, John, when I was in middle school, and it was actually the book Suffer the Children at that point that caught my attention. Now, the book actually came out in, if I'm correct, 1977. Is that when it was finally published?
Yep.
Okay. Okay, so you have done something that very few authors have achieved, and that's your very first book ended up being a million-copy bestseller. With that story, Suffer the Children, I want you to take us back, because that was 1977. What was it that motivated that story, that brought that story about, and did you really believe that it would become what it did, or was it just one of those things that you were taking a chance on?
With Suffer the Children, there was very little left to chance, actually. It's the story of Suffer the Children is kind of interesting because although it was certainly the first book published with my name on it, it was certainly not the first book I wrote. There are a whole lot that will never see the light of day, and there are a whole lot that saw the light of day in other venues and will never see the light of day again, I hope. But with Suffer the Children, I was trying to break into publishing, which is not an easy thing to do. I had, however, acquired a literary agent in New York who had read a comedy murder mystery I'd written several years earlier that she was utterly unable to sell. Eventually, she managed to pull it off, but that wasn't for a very long time. And when I went into New York one time and looked her up and talked to her, we talked for about an hour, I guess, and finally she said, you know, you have a terrific name for the cover of a book because it's two short words that they can put on in great big letters. I said, okay. And she said, well, you're reasonably presentable and reasonably well-spoken, so that makes you promotable. I think we can build a career for you. And I said, well, doesn't that involve books? And she said, well, yes, there is that. And she said, what I want you to do is go back and write something into the marketplace. You've been having a good time writing what you wanted to write. Now, why don't you see if you can figure out what people want to read and write into that? So I went home and I checked around and I did some research. Actually, I didn't that time that much. I just sat down and started writing what I thought would be a mainstream thriller involving CB radios and the trucking business because that was very hot at the moment. I finally got half a manuscript, which I sent to the agent, who sent it to an editor, who looked at it and said, I like the way this guy writes, but I already have my CB Trucker book, and even if he finishes it and it's wonderful and I buy it, by the time I can publish it, that whole thing's going to be over with anyway. What I would like to propose is that this guy try to write something to compete with a writer at another house named Stephen King. And my agent said, I'll talk to him, called me up, and I said, who's Stephen King, having never heard of the man?
Oh, wow.
Well, it was 1976, you know. Stephen King was just barely on the horizon. So my agent told me who he was and suggested maybe I ought to check things out. So I checked things out in my typical unorthodox method. Instead of going to the local library or the local bookstore, I went to the local supermarket, and sure enough, there was a Stephen King book on the racks. And so I picked it up, and I read the back of it. And then I noticed there were about three or four other books on the bestseller racks that looked pretty much like they might be the same theme. And I read the backs of them, and sure enough, they were. And I thought, you know, I bet I could do that. It looks like basically what you need is something involving a psychological occult thriller involving children, and I don't like children all that much. I don't have a problem killing a few kids off in a book. So I came up with this idea with my partner of what if there were these two little girls, and one of them everyone knew was crazy, but it was the one everyone thought was sane that was actually killing all their little friends. And the agent liked it, the editor liked it, asked for an outline, so I wrote an outline for the novel, and having not until that point ever known what an outline for a novel was, but my agent explained that to me too. They liked the outline, and there was only one small catch to the whole thing, which was that the editor wanted to publish it in the following summer, the summer of 77, which meant she had to have the manuscript no later than very early January. And the agent called and said, can you do that? And I looked at the calendar, saw that it was November 23rd, and said, sure, I can do that. Not a problem. So basically, I wrote the book in 30 days. Actually, I wrote it in 27 days. It's 27 chapters, and I wrote a chapter a day back to back, simply because I had no choice. And it turned out fine. And the interesting thing was, for pretty much from the moment they got the outline, they were talking in terms of this was going to be a bestseller. I had no idea that a lot of editors and agents talk in terms of bestsellers, and it never happens. Since I had absolutely no experience with agents or editors, I assumed they knew what they were talking about. As it turned out, with that one, they did. So I was very fortunate that I had a very powerful team of people supporting me. The woman who at the time ran Dell outright, Helen Myers, read the outline, allowed the editor to buy it, and by that, I choose the word allowed very carefully. She did not encourage her to buy it. In fact, at the beginning, she flat out refused to buy it. And then the editor said, Mrs. Meyer, you can buy it at this price today, or you can wait 3 months, and you can pay five times this amount just for the paperback rights. At which point, Mrs. Meyer made a proposition. She said to the editor, okay, if you truly believe that, here's what we'll do. I will buy it. I will put the full force of the company behind it and see if we can, for the first time in history, put an original paperback novel by an unknown writer onto the New York Times bestseller list. If we succeed, we all get rich. If we fail, you're fired. Can you live with that? And my editor said, yes, I can live with that. So I didn't know for years that the editor had literally put her job on the line for that book. But it gave everyone great motivation to make sure things went well, and they did. And the rest, as they say, is history. It's a sort of, it took off, and I've stayed with the editor through her entire career, first through Dell, then as she rose up to be president of Bantam, and then president of Ballantine. She is unfortunately no longer among those present, but I miss her a lot.
So
that's the quick story of how I got here.
And you know, that's one story you didn't share with me last year. So it was I guess it just wasn't the time. I mean, because that really is amazing to think of how that worked. And it brings up an interesting point. Before we get into that, I do want to welcome those that are just joining us. You're listening to Conversations Live. I'm your host, Cyrus Webb, and we're talking with, for the hour, best-selling author John Saul. In a moment, we're going to get into his brand-new book, Faces of Fear. Right now, we're talking about his beginnings as an author and how his first book, Suffer the Children, became a million-copy bestseller nationwide. Now, John, one of the things you mentioned was that your publisher was looking for someone to compete with someone named Stephen King. Now, the competitive nature of the literary business is notorious these days. Was there as much pressure then when you first began as far as competing? Because, you know, since you threw out that name, then you have other authors like such as Dean Koontz that are out there. Did you feel that competitive nature when the book became a bestseller?
I certainly did not. I never have. I have never felt that writers are in competition with each other. Every writer has their own audience, and certainly Steve has an audience that's far larger than mine, and Dean does too now. Back in 1977, nobody had ever heard of Dean. He was not even on the horizon yet, I don't think. I've always found that, generally speaking, everyone looks for the story they want to read, and if they really like what Steve's doing, they're probably going to like what I'm doing a little less. If they really like what I'm doing, they're probably going to like what Steve's doing a little less. It all depends on personal taste. I know there have been a lot of authors who have I know when The Green Mile came out, there were a whole lot of authors who were very upset that Steve had 8 or 7 spots on the bestseller list at one point, all 6 of the Green Mile series plus a standalone book. And everyone was screaming, oh, that's terrible. He shouldn't be allowed to have all these spots. They should call The Green Mile all one book. And it went on and on. And I was called, what did I think? And I said, yeah, more power to him. Now, mind you, I may have partly said that because I got one of those leftover spots he wasn't occupying. So I might have been a lot less sanguine had I not had that. But I've just never seen writers as being in competition with each other. I know we are supposed to be, but and I suppose some do feel like they're terribly competitive. I know some of the true crime people do feel very competitive, and I suppose that makes more sense because they're writing nonfiction and they're sort of covering the same turf. And I suppose if you're actually covering the same turf with a bunch of other writers, you would get competitive and try to find the best cases and grab onto them and make them your own. But when you're writing fiction and basically you're writing from your own imagination, nobody else has your imagination, so who is there to compete with?
Mm-hmm. Good point. You know, I was curious about to be today this this atmosphere of who's going to be out there first. You don't want to release your book this time because this person's coming out with a book. So, I mean, it's interesting to hear from your perspective, someone with your success say that you don't think about it in that competitive way as, you know, as some do, because for some it's all about getting that
right.
Know, the best financial impact.
No. Now the
book.
Yeah, but the publishers, of course, certainly have a valid point. My publisher would be rather stupid to put one of my books out head-to-head with Stephen King's, because we are appealing to the basic same overall audience. He certainly has his fans, I have mine. But books are at a price point now where if you've got two hardcover books out there in the same month, most people are going to take their choice of one or the other. They're not going to spring for both simply because two books is now, you know, that's the same as a tank of gas these days. And a lot of people can barely afford the gasoline, so it becomes a problem. But that's really among the publishers more than it is among the writers. And now I suppose if I, as a writer, I suddenly were faced with going into the store someday and seeing that my new book was just released and so was Steve's and so was Dean's, I might call my publisher and say, what on earth were you thinking? But at the same time, they would also be calling their publisher saying, what are you thinking? So,
John, we just got a question in the chat room here, and we've had some activity in there. One of the individuals in the chat room says that you ought to write a book about the IRS. But one of the other ones brings up a point about collaborations. We know that there are a lot of collaborations in the industry, and one of the questions was, have you ever considered doing anything with Stephen King, a collaborative effort with him?
Actually, no. I have never been that interested in collaborations, and there are a few of them that have worked. Generally speaking, the collaboration is good for the lesser known of the two of writers and bad for the better known of the two writers. And it's sort of, you know, to me, a story needs one voice to be told in, I think. And I've seen some collaborators, like, you know, James Patterson is doing a lot of collaborations now. I picked up one of them. And it was so clear who was writing what. I sort of dumped the book after the first three chapters because one of the writers was competent and one of the writers was not. I wasted my money on it, and I'm not going to finish it. And second of all, I'm done with any more James Patterson novels that have another name on them. So, it's just... No, I'm not a fan of them. Let's put it that way.
Look, I definitely understand. I can understand that. For
now, on the other hand, let me give you the other side of the coin.
Sure, go ahead.
From the publisher's point of view, as, again, a function of the marketplace and how much books cost, it's getting harder and harder for the publishers to sell new authors. If they can get the new author into a team relationship with a well-known author, they can market the books much more strongly. What happens is often a writer will start out teamed with a bigger name and then spin off on their own. And basically, the more big names they can have on the stands, the better off they are. So... makes sense from a publishing point of view.
Mm-hmm. But it's just something personal that you're not interested in.
Right.
Okay. All right. And that's fair enough. I think with your history, I think it's safe to say you could stand alone. So I don't think that's something you'll have to worry about. For those that are just joining us again, you're listening to Conversations Live. I'm your host, Cyrus Webb. We're talking with, for the hour, best-selling author John Saul. John, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back from the break, we're going to get into the new book, Faces of Fear, and also open up the lines to take some questions from those that are listening. Again, the number to call in for questions is area code 347-426-3645. That's 347-426-3645. Taking us into break is the Patrick Smith Band again with one of my favorite songs. This is Virginia from the Patrick Smith Band. We'll be right back after this break.
I want to invite all my music lovers to join my addiction and get hooked on books. Visit www.hiphopandbooks.com and see how we can work together to get others to fall in love with reading again. To find out more information about me, visit me online at www.myspace.com/Dwayne Scott. That's www.myspace.com/DuaneScott. And look for the CD coming out soon. It's just music. And we out.
Thank you for that, Dwayne Scott. And as far as the music goes, thank you again to the Patrick Smith Band, one of my favorite songs, Virginia, off of their self-titled album. And we're back with Conversations Live with our special guest, John Saul. John, when we went to break, we said that we were going to talk about the new project, because last year when we had the last conversation on the show, you were promoting, of course, The Devil's Labyrinth. It went on, of course, to be a bestseller. Just last week, you released the new book, Faces of Fear. For our listeners that have not heard of the book or may not be familiar with the storyline, why don't you tell them a little bit about the book?
Well, it's set in Los Angeles, actually not all of Los Angeles. Primarily it's set in the Beverly Hills area, and it's concerned with a teenage girl, Allison Shaw, whose mother, through various circumstances, winds up marrying a very well-known and very skilled plastic surgeon, and the girl begins feeling some pressure to have some work done that she's not at all sure she wants done. And needless to say, since it's a John Saul book, the knives do get wielded eventually. And I'm not going to give a whole lot more than that away.
Well, look, as I was telling them in the chat room, I read the book in just a couple of days. It definitely is one of my favorites. And, of course, I guess the question that many people would be asking, because I mentioned earlier, John, that you've written now over 30 titles, how do you still, maintain your relevance today? Because it's amazing. Every time a John Saul book comes out, you wonder how can you top the last one, and you always seem to do it. So, I mean, for you, how do you, keep that relevance in the literary world?
Well, now you frightened me. now the pressure is on. I don't really think about that much. What I'm always thinking in terms of is coming up with a story that's going to make an interesting book and then telling the story as well as I possibly can. And for me, usually, if a story is going to be interesting to a reader in the present, it has to be pretty relevant to what's going on in the present. Sometimes I seem to anticipate the present. Years ago when I wrote Creature, most people weren't thinking in terms of using steroids and human growth hormones to beef up athletes. I postulated it in what I thought was bizarre fiction, and then it turned out that it wasn't nearly as bizarre as I had thought it was within a few years. In fact, the weird thing is I sort of invented the whole idea of what would happen out of whole cloth. I put in the whole concept of if you abuse these drugs, you wind up having a side effect of inducing rage as a literary gambit. It allowed for a lot of action and interest and made these people dangerous. I had no clue at all that it would turn out that would be one of the side effects. What they call roid rage is an absolute real, and I sort of anticipated it by a couple of years in that book. But I have no idea. Somehow it always sort of comes together, so it winds up being fairly relevant, as long as I'm aware of what's going on in the present world, and I tend to keep up as well as I can.
Exactly. Well, I don't know how you do it either, but you manage to do it every time. I was blown away, by The Devil's Labyrinth last year, and even in that book, speaking of current events, of course, the war was mentioned in that particular book with the Iraq War there, mm-hmm. And now with this one, another one that definitely, with the big fascination over looks and also beauty, mm-hmm. and man's idea of beauty, and mm-hmm. You definitely continue to do it. John, we have a caller from Arizona that is now on the line. Caller, go ahead.
Well, hello, Mr. Saul. I'm a big fan of yours. This is Pop Art Diva CA.
Hello.
I did want to ask just a quick question. I have a hard time applying the term horror to you and Stephen King. it's sort of
join
like
the club.
I know. I mean, it's like putting you in both of you are excellent writers, and it seems to take away from your talent. It bothers me because you get I know I'm an artist. I know how creative types get boxed in. And I would wonder if, Mr. Paul, how would you term your genre of writing?
I consider myself a thriller writer. I've never considered myself a horror writer. I've always considered what I do is thrillers of all kinds of different genres. Some of them fit more easily into the horror box than others, but not many of them fit in really well at all. And I used to, back in the days when I was out touring every year, it never failed that I would be being interviewed by someone who would say, I don't understand why they call you a horror writer. This is not horror. But that's what they told me it was. I hadn't read you before because I don't like horror. I read this because I was going to be interviewing you, and it's not horror. It's a thriller. It's a good thriller. I have gone around this with the publishers for years and years and years. I went around it with the publisher no more than 3 weeks ago. And the problem is they need to have a box in which to put a book. And the only box they can think of to put me in and Steve in is the horror box. And again, it's purely a marketing thing. It's trying at least to give the bookstore people and the libraries a handle on where to put the works so that the largest potential audience can find them. I personally think it's limiting. I know that there are a whole lot more people that would enjoy my books but don't bother to read them because they're marketed as horror. How to fight that? I don't know. I haven't been able to win at that one in years and years and years.
I actually have a suggestion.
Oh, you do? Tell me,
do,
please.
I do. I used to illustrate books, and I was just wondering if you could publish the same book with a different cover, same time,
mm-hmm.
and publish it in a different category.
Uh-huh.
It's sort of like, I mean, I do a lot of different artwork, so I have a lot of different online, you know, names. Everything comes under Papa
yep.
Zupa, but
yep.
but maybe they could run two simultaneous marketing publicity campaigns. One is a thriller, one is horror. You know, your writing is so much richer than the box that they put you in, as is the case with many authors. But particularly horror and science fiction get kind of boxed in particular, and mm-hmm. it's very upsetting when the authors are as good as you are.
Well, you know, a few years ago, maybe 10 years ago, I could have taken your idea to my publisher, and they would have said, what a fabulous idea. Let's try it and see what happens. Unfortunately, back in those days, the mass market of books was doing very, very well, and there was a lot of money in the business that they could play with. Now it's really, really difficult for them to find the money to do one marketing program, let alone two. It's one of those experiments that could have happened a few years ago, but can't happen now. They used to experiment with me all the time. They sort of knew what my base sales were going to be going out the door. I'm what's known in the trade as a very dependable writer. So what they did 1 year was they decided that they would try putting a discount belly band on some of the books and see what happened. And what happened, they discovered, was the ones without the belly band sold better than the ones that did. And then 1 year they thought, well, let's put out a paperback edition, but let's price it a dollar below what is the current standard. And I said, gee, thanks, that's going to affect my royalties. And they said, actually, no, it's not, because your advance was big enough that's not going to earn out at either price. So I said, oh, well, given that, and I said, Sand, and what about the numbers? If it bombs, what happens? And they said, we guarantee we will not hold it against you. And so they did it, and sure enough, the numbers dropped. And the next year, when they put me out at full retail, the numbers went back up again. And it turned out that apparently what the public thought was, they put the book out at a cheap price because they didn't think much of it, and why would they want to buy a second-rate book?
Oh, wow.
So, you know?
Public perception can kill you, can't it? When it comes
it absolutely can. I mean, that's the last thing any of us thought would happen, but we did the experiment, and we learned something, which is if you discount books too deeply, people think something's wrong with them. Very strange business.
Overnight, your marketing campaign turned you into what people thought of as a hack. Isn't that wonderful?
Exactly. Yes, exactly.
Well, maybe you should write a book about a horror author who, you know, you need to write a horror book about a horror author who tries to cross over and the marketing boogeyman gets him or something.
Yeah, it gets harder to make that crossover every year. On the other hand, I have to say that having been pigeonholed, it's been a very comfortable hole to be pigeoned in.
Well, I have to thank you. I've loved your book for years. And
oh, thank you.
I was just so excited to see this show, and I have to thank CA for having you, and I'll shut up and let other people talk now.
Okay.
Well,
no
it's such
problem.
A pleasure
thank
to talk
so
to you.
Thanks for calling in.
Now, John, Pop Art Diva mentioned a very interesting point, and I want to follow up on that because she mentioned with her artwork that she uses different names.
Mm-hmm.
Is that something that you've thought about writing under a pseudonym under another genre?
Oh, sure. And I've done it.
You've done it?
Yes, but it's a pseudonym, right?
Right. Okay, I guess I opened myself up for that. Well, okay.
I never said that I only write under my own name.
Very, very true, very true. So do you like that freedom of being able to go after a different audience to see what the thoughts are about your work?
Well, a part of it, there's a certain amount of freedom, but I also have to understand that I have had a very successful career with a name that's associated very strongly with one rather broad genre of thrillers. If there's another book I really want to write because I think it's a wonderful book, I now have the freedom to write that, and it will get published. Whether it will get published in a manner that earns any money for me or the publisher is a whole different question. One of my favorite stories is my old comedy murder mystery that my agent could never sell. Finally, she got a call from an editor who shall remain nameless, from a house that shall remain nameless, and he said, "Do you remember that book John Saul wrote before he became John Saul?" And my agent said, "Yes." And he said, "Is that still available?" And she said, "Of course." And he said, "Well, I've finally risen to a position with my publisher where I can actually buy a book that I just like, even though I know it's going to lose money. And I always liked that manuscript, and I would like to publish it, but you have to understand that the advance is going to be minuscule and that John should not expect there to be any royalties following the advance." So my agent called me and explained, and I said, "Sure. You know, why not? The book's already there. It's not like he was asking me to write a new book."
Exactly.
And so he bought it, and he published it. And then he sent me a lovely letter not terribly long later, in which he said, "Dear John, as you know, in the life of every book, there is a time for publishing and there is a time for remaindering. In the case of your book, the time for remaindering has come. How many would you like to buy before we destroy them or send them out to the remainder tables?"
Wow.
And then actually the paperback rights did sell to that eventually too, to another editor who knew perfectly well who had written it. And she called and she said, "I want to buy the paperback rights to that book, but I can only buy serials at this point. If you're not doing a series, I can't buy it. They told me all I can acquire is series." And I said, "You know perfectly well I'm not going to write any more of those." And she said, "Yes, I know that and you know that, but are you willing to let me lie and claim you are so I can acquire this? And then after I publish it and it tanks, then you can say you're not going to write any more, and what can they do?" So I said, sure, I'll go along with it. So she bought it. She published it and sold enough copies. Actually, she did make her money back. She did all right with it. And that was the end of it. But so it does give me the freedom to try different things. And given what my real name is, most publishers would gamble on pretty much anything I wanted to put out under another name, frankly, on the off chance that if they should publish a synonymous book really, really well, I might consider coming over to them sometime with my real name. Most of them know that since I've been at the same publisher my entire career, that's highly unlikely to happen. But hope springs eternal.
You know, and I just think that story is just so funny because even you get a Dear John letter. That's fascinating to me. But for those that are joining us, you're listening to Conversations Live. Our guest for the hour has been John Saul, the author of the brand-new book, Faces of Fear. John, I want to ask you this as a follow-up to what we were just talking about as far as the judging success, and especially with a career like the one that you've had. What for you has been the biggest professional disappointment in your long career?
Oh, boy, the biggest professional disappointment. I can't say that it has been in the major career. I actually set out originally to be a playwright, not a novelist. And I have come close to productions, major productions of a couple of plays a couple of times that have blown up at the last minute and something's gone wrong. And so not having seen a major production, never having been on Broadway, basically. I always wanted to be a Broadway playwright, and I've come close a few times, but it's never quite come together. So that's probably been the biggest disappointment.
Okay. And that's something that you're still working on today?
Oh, you better believe it.
Okay.
In fact, I am currently working on a show for Norwegian Cruise Lines, interactive mystery to be performed aboard ship. First time, as far as anybody knows, it's the first time anyone has actually written theater for the cruise industry, ship-centric theater, as it were.
No, when I look back at the books of yours, and I've out of the 30-plus books that you've written, I've read 14 of them, and I was going through and preparing for this interview, trying to think of the one.
Wait a minute. I wrote 35 books, and you only read 14 of them? What kind of fan are you?
If I could
spend my time writing them, the least you can do is spend some time reading them.
I know, and you know, but I do try to stay current.
I do try to stay current. Good recovery.
But one of the things that I was thinking about, John, and the ones that I have read, is in preparing for this, I was trying to think the one that probably made the biggest impact on me. Mm-hmm. And I would have to say it was Comes the Blind Fury.
Hmm.
And I think because I could relate to that feeling of being rejected in a sense,
mm-hmm.
and wanting to exact some form of revenge, not quite to the extreme. But
not just throw them off the cliff.
Yeah, but, you know.
I like throwing them off the cliff. I thought that was kind of fun.
You know, it's so funny that you would say that. One of the comments that was in the chat room was, hate kids? Write horror about them. But that... But I do think when I look at that book, Comes the Blind Fury, mm-hmm. that probably has been the one, like I said, that stands the most to me. Is that one that you would like to see actually come to the screen either as a play or as a movie?
Boy, I don't know. That's not one of the ones that has ever leapt to my mind as a natural movie. The only time I ever actually wrote with movie in mind was Cry for the Strangers. And interestingly, it's the only one that ever got made. I tend to write more for books than for film, and I think there's a big difference in story structure. And I learned a lesson when they finally did make Cry for the Strangers. I'm one of those lucky few who was able to recognize his book completely because they followed it far too slavishly. And I realized that my books are very plot-heavy, and they insisted on putting all the plot points into a two-hour movie. Well, you have to cut out something in order to carve my 400-page book down to a 90-page screenplay. It was probably a 120-page screenplay. What they cut out was the motivation for all of the action. So I watched all the action, and it didn't even make sense to me because they didn't have time to include all the action and the motivation for it all. So it was a bizarre experience. And since then, I've realized why it's so difficult to translate my work to the screen. It's very plot-heavy, and a lot of it's very difficult to figure out where you would cut, because I tend to cut out as much extraneous material as possible. Elmore Leonard once said, I think it was Elmore, maybe it wasn't, but somebody once said, I try never to write the parts that no one's going to read. And I do, too. I tend to try to make sure that everyone's going to read every paragraph, because they skip a few paragraphs or scan a couple pages, they're going to miss something important. So once I've got that carved down to the point where I sort of refer to it as it's cut down to the point where if you pull anything else out, the entire house of cards collapses.
Well, you know, and it's just amazing. I was just curious. In fact, I think we're going to post that on our website as one of our questions for our readers, is which one of your books would we like to see brought to the big screen?
Mm-hmm.
Because I went back and reread Comes the Blind Fury when you agreed to do this interview, and I thought, wow, this book just – I mean, today I could just see what they could do with that story, especially since Hollywood loves evil kids.
Yeah,
I thought, wow, this would be one I would love to see. John, we're going to take one more quick break. When we come back from break this time, we're going to let our listeners know exactly where they can find you, as far as with the new books, also information about how they can join your online reading list, your mailing list that you have on your website as well.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to take one more break. We'll be right back with our guest, best-selling author John Stahl. In fact, I see in the chat room we have Big G out of Florida on the line. We're going to play his commercial that he's done for our Hip Hop and Books Literacy campaign. John, one of the things our program has done is formed a musical enterprise where we have recording artists that have teamed up with their listeners to encourage reading.
Super.
So Big G is one of the participants of that. He's out of Florida. This is his commercial for the project. We'll be right back with John Stahl.
Are you all dilated? Can you do me a favor?
Okay, John, tell me we're not going to break. We are going to go ahead and continue with finding out information about your website. I thought we were going to break there.
Oh, you mean we've been sitting here providing dead air for everybody?
I know, isn't that terrific?
That's a good way to lose our audience.
I thought
I must have been put on hold because I'm not hearing the break. And I thought, okay, it never occurred to me to say something like, is anything going on here?
Well, John, your website, I mean, you're very, very accessible. Your website is johnstahl.com. One
mm-hmm.
of the things that you provided on there is a way for your fans to communicate with you.
Yep.
Tell our listeners why that's important for you.
Well, it's always good to get feedback. It's important to a writer. You know, writing is one of the things that has no instant gratification whatsoever. You write a book, and you don't know whether it's good, bad, or indifferent, and you don't know whether it's good, bad, or indifferent literally for months after you're done with it. By the time the book comes out and is on the market, you're working on the next one, operating in yet another vacuum. And so the only real way you have of finding out what people are thinking of what you've been doing is having a website that's really accessible where people can let you know. We used to get a lot of fan mail on, you know, remember snail mail?
Exactly.
We used to get a lot of snail mail. We get a lot more email simply because the web has made it so much easier for people to express themselves and send what they're thinking in to the writer. I know at the moment we're holding a sweepstakes for people coming up with good blurbs for the book. And people who've read the book and have something they want to say about it, send us email, and so the best of them are going to go up on the website as real readers comment on real books.
Wow. Do I qualify the internet?
Although I have to tell you that if someone says this is the worst book ever written, we're not likely to put that up on our own site.
Well, look, I was so excited. I was trying to, I have to admit, I went to the store actually the Monday before it was to come out. And because I have a good friend of mine that's the manager of the Borders.
Mm-hmm.
And I asked them very politely if I could buy the book because I wanted to be one of the first ones
mm-hmm.
to post a review on Amazon. So I was very excited.
And they said, no, you couldn't. Are we still here? I'm not hearing you anymore. I'm not hearing you. If you're hearing me, say something. I think you've lost me. Hello?
Hello, John, are you there?
I'm here. You vanished. I'm not hearing. I heard you for a split second. Hello? Well, this is John Saul. I'm either on web radio or I'm not. I have no idea anymore. Now I'm wondering whether I should do a monologue praising myself and my work and flogging my books.
Hello, John. Can you hear us?
You're breaking up badly. I sort of heard you then.
Oh.
There, you're back, I think.
Okay, can you hear me now?
Yeah, hear you now fine.
Great. I was just asking about some of the feedback you've gotten from critics. Has it surprised you how not only your readers, but also critics have enjoyed your work as well?
My favorite review story is from years ago, back when the publishers used to clip all the reviews and then put them in a big envelope and send them to me. And I was reading them for The God Project many years ago. And there was one from the Vancouver British Columbia Sun. And it said that The God Project was certainly the best book of the decade, if not the century, or most important book of the decade, if not the century. It was the Frankenstein for the nuclear age, and it went on and on. It was the review a writer would have written of their own work. And I thought, boy, this is great. I'm really a good writer. Yippee. And then I go to the next review, which is from the Orange County, California Register, I think. And it says, John Saul pushes his usual cardboard cast through his usual predictable plot. And I thought, okay, I better stop paying any attention to the critics either way. So that's where I wound up with reviews. Now I basically don't read them. I do my best to ignore them. Although I've discovered I can count on my friends to notify me when there's a really bad one out there.
Okay. Well, John, we are definitely glad to have talked to you, and we believe us when we say that you're definitely one of our favorites. Our guest again today has been best-selling author John Saul. He's the author of over 30 novels, and his brand-new book is out now, Faces of Fear. Definitely request it at your bookstore if you don't have it already, and make sure you let him know through his website at johnsaul.com exactly what you think of it. John, thank you again so much for taking out this time with us today.
And thank you very much for having me again. It's always fun to be on your show.
Definitely. And for all of our listeners, as always, thank you for your support. We'll be right back here with Conversations Live next week. As always, enjoy your day, enjoy your life, enjoy enjoy your world, and make sure you enjoy a great book. This is Cyrus Webb saying until next time, have a great day.
What's up, everybody? This is your boy, Big G. I want to encourage all of my music lovers to join my addiction and get hooked on books. Visit www.hiphopandbooks.com. Again, www.hiphopandbooks.com, and see how we can all work together to promote reading again. For more information about me, visit www.myspace.com/spikevolleyballforlife. That's www.myspace.com/spikevolleyball4life. All right? I hope to see you there. And remember, have some fun. Get a book and get hooked. I don't